rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. It's the first hour of the last day of the week here. Happy Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, whatever it may be for you. And, of course, in the first hour, we always talk with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Clay, you're going to need to drop that gain on the phone line there when I'm speaking, or the thank you. Clay, new to running the board here. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives, and now running for the United States Senate from Vermont as an independent. His website, Bernie.org. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, toll-free all across the United States. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, you can go to TomHartman.com. Congressman Bernie Sanders, welcome. Good morning, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. Bernie, I was this morning speaking with Tom Chamberlain, who's the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and he was telling me about, and in fact gave me a whole bunch of information here, on the Oman Free Trade Pact. This thing just passed the Senate. It totally flew beneath my radar. I didn't even know it was happening. 60-34 vote in the Senate, and it's gone to the House. And Oman is a country, it's one of the Gulf states. They ban labor unions. They've been cited by the U.S. Department of Labor for human trafficking and forced labor. Under OFTA, this is called, the Oman Free Trade Agreement, it would give foreign corporations more rights than U.S. citizens because it allows any company incorporated in Oman to sue the U.S. government in a secret tribunal demanding payment from our tax dollars. And it also, according to the AFL-CIO, would undermine U.S. national security by promoting rights for foreign companies, including government-owned companies, to operate our sensitive infrastructure such as electricity grids and port operations. In other words, once this trade pact with Oman is signed, this is an oil-rich Gulf state, if Oman decides that the Oman port company wants to buy the port of Boston or the port of, right, of Pittsburgh or the Philadelphia or what, those aren't ports, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Then by law, we can't stop it like we just did with Dubai. Your thoughts on this and on these crazy trade deals in general?
Well, I think that this is very clearly a continuation of a trade policy which amounts to a major attack against the middle class and working families of this country. And the results are there for anybody to see. You know, Tom, 10, 15 years ago, we might have had a serious debate about the wisdom of these trade agreements, but I think the results are in. And the results are very clear that what's happened as a result of all of these trade agreements is our national debt has, trade deficit has soared. We're now over $700 billion, record-breaking trade deficit. We have lost 1.9 million good-paying manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years, and about half of them are attributed to our trade policies. Large corporation after large corporation is running to foreign countries to hire cheap labor while they're throwing American workers out on the street. And the result of all of these trade agreements, including this new one, is that we will continue to see a decline in the middle class of America, an increase in poverty, and a growth between the gap of in the rich and the poor. Rich are getting richer, and poor are getting poorer, and the middle class is shrinking. And these trade policies are an intricate part of that whole process. So I certainly will vote against this agreement, which, needless to say, will be supported by virtually every large corporation in America who thinks it's just a great idea to be able to move into companies where workers have no rights, where you can exploit poor people in those countries, and you can save money by throwing American workers out on the street. So I think the time is not just to reject this particular trade agreement, but to rethink our entire trade policy. I have legislation in which has strong bipartisan support, I should say, a number of Republicans on it as well, which would repeal permanent normal trade relations with China. You know, we begin to take for granted, and what is, I think, a real serious problem now, You know, we go into a store and you buy a product, buy a television, you buy a computer, whatever you buy a pair of shoes, you buy a shirt, and you assume, oh, yeah, of course, this product is made in China. We don't manufacture these products in America anymore. Well, we better stop assuming those things. We better stop taking the fact that we no longer are manufacturing products that we produce. We shouldn't take that for granted anymore, because that is a very dangerous trend for the future of this country. I don't know how you maintain a strong economy if you're not manufacturing the goods that the people consume. So I think the time is long overdue to rethink our trade policies, which have clearly failed us, and to demand that large corporations start producing products in the United States of America rather than in Oman, rather than in China.
Yeah, amen. And, in fact, this actually just came out of the House Ways and Means Committee yesterday. Straight party line vote. 23 Republicans voted in favor of it. 15 Democrats voted against it.
Well, I must say, Tom, on that issue, that on that particular committee, I'm glad that we saw that vote.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not glad. I'm just, that proposal should have lost.
Yeah.
But Democrats on some of these issues have been much weaker than they should have been.
Yeah. And it's just mind-boggling. Bernie, you mentioned, we were talking before we got on the air, and you mentioned the media in the United States as
a
concern.
You know, I think, Tom, in the same sense that we now take for granted that when we go to a store, the products we're going to buy are not made in the United States of America, that we're losing good-paying blue-collar jobs, that we're on the cusp of losing millions of good-paying white-collar information technology jobs. And I think, oh, well, that's the way it is. Well, the bottom line of that's the way it is that unless we change those policies, our children are, for the first time in modern American history, going to have a lower standard of living than their parents do. And as part of that whole process and trying to understand what's going on in our country, why is poverty increasing? Why are 5 million more Americans living in poverty today than before Bush became president? Why is our deficit soaring? Why do we have a $700 billion trade deficit? Why is the gap between the rich and the poor growing wider? To understand these issues, I think, and to understand public consciousness in America, one has got to take a hard look at the media. And right now, as you may know, there is another attempt being brought forth by the Bush administration to quote-unquote deregulate media, which will mean that we will even have fewer large multimedia conglomerates owning and controlling what the American people see, hear, and read. And in my view, it is not possible to have a vibrant democracy where we have honest discussions about the real issues facing the American people unless you have a media which is prepared to allow discourse on all kinds of subjects. And what I worry about very much is that what appears on the front pages of papers, what appears more importantly on television, is as often as not an effort to deflect attention away from the real issues. That we are down to sound bites, that we're down to sensationalism, that there is not the kind of thorough exploration of the real issues facing the American people that should be the case. In other words, just, you know, I would hope the listeners ask themselves, how often do they see on TV a discussion about the fact that the United States is the only nation in the industrialized world that does not have a national health care program? How often do we talk about the morality? You know, in Washington, we have a president who's very concerned about moral values. Well, what about the moral value of the United States having the most unfair distribution of wealth and income of any major country? So the number of millionaires and billionaires is soaring at the same time as we have the high. Highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. How often do we see that moral issue discussed on television? So I would hope that we begin to look at media as a political issue, to understand that if we're concerned about the environment, if we're concerned about workers' rights, if we're concerned about education in America, all of those issues are part, have got to be looked at in terms of how the media presents them.
Well, the Bush administration certainly views all, the media as a political issue. Look at other, how aggressively they are stacking the FCC and trying to stack the Board of Public Broadcasting.
Oh, that's right. Not to mention, you know, in Iraq, for example, putting on the payroll Iraqi in writers as
right.
part of their administration to tout the party line.
Yeah,
and
basically
not to mention,
shills.
I think, most importantly, in the last month, attacking the New York Times.
Yeah.
For committing the crime of describing what the Bush administration is doing. So that you're right, they do understand the importance of media.
Yeah, and it's time for the rest of us to. Well said. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. If you have a question you'd like to talk to a member of Congress here, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our number toll-free all across the United States, 866-440-8466, 440-THOM. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears.
And welcome back. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. All right, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders here with us, independent congressman from Vermont running for the United States Senate. His website, bernie.org, if you want to check that out. Our toll-free number all across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. Bernie, a question for you. I'm assuming you're familiar with this whole Kentucky River thing that the AFL-CIO is doing battle with the Bush administration on the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. Four of their appointees apparently are about to rule in this Kentucky River case that if you are a supervisor, in quotes, then you can't be a member of a union, and therefore any nurse, for example, who has scheduling responsibilities can't be a member of a union. Any foreman on a shop floor can't be a member. And this could wipe out, this morning I was told by the AFL-CIO, it could wipe out 8 million union memberships. And the Bush administration is just going to do this. Is there anything that Congress can do to stop this Kentucky River thing?
Of course there is, and you know, ultimately, Congress is the body that makes the laws of the land. So, of course, Congress can act. It remains to be seen whether Congress will act. What I should say, Tom, is that this is just part of a continued attack by the Bush administration against working Americans, against the middle class, and against trade unionism. They understand that when workers come together for collective bargaining, they have the capability of standing up and fighting for decent wages and decent working conditions. And the Bush administration, time after time after time, comes down on the sides of the wealthy, the powerful, the big employers against workers. And this is consistent with that effort. Let me tell you something else when you're talking about nurses. Not discussed terribly much is that in the recent immigration bill passed by the U.S. Senate, there was a provision in it which would substantially increase the number of foreign nurses who could come into our country. Here we have a situation in America where over 100,000 Americans applied to go to nursing school and were rejected because the nursing schools do not have the faculty and the capability of educating those people. Can you believe that?
Amazing. So instead of putting money into our nursing schools, we're saying, let's bring in people from, you know, nurses from Bangladesh or from Mexico or whatever, because they'll work cheaper.
Philippines is a major source.
Yeah.
And the impact of that is to, A, lower wages in America, is to radically disrupt the health care systems in the Philippines and in other countries. So here you have just, again, a situation where you have young people who want to go into the very important, needed, honorable profession of nursing, do real important work for healthcare in America, earn a decent wage. We don't have the resources in the United States of America to educate them. So we're going to bring people in from the Philippines. And then when we have people who are in nursing, why then the Bush administration wants to break unions and lower wages.
And plus, when they're in nursing school, they want to raise their student loans.
Exactly. I mean, you know, It is almost beyond comprehension.
Yeah, it really and truly is. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, toll-free across the United States. Jonathan in Santa Monica, California. Jonathan, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Tom, and good morning, Congressman Sanders.
Hi, John.
I have two quick questions. The first is, Congressman, you represent virtually everything I believe in as a progressive Democrat. I'm wondering how you perceive it benefits you to be an independent rather than a Democrat.
Well, I have always functioned outside of the two-party system. I was elected mayor of the city of Burlington in 1981 as an independent, in fact, defeating a Democrat at that point, and I've run against Republicans and Democrats over the years. I think what we have right now, Jonathan, in America is a Republican Party which is extremely right-wing and a Democratic Party which is more or less centrist. There are some wonderful people in the Democratic Party in Congress who I work with day in and day out. We helped form the Progressive Caucus when I first came, which has some terrific, terrific people. But, you know, in my state and from my political history, I feel very comfortable working at this moment as an independent. I support the Democratic leadership and get my committee assignments from the Democratic leadership in the House. And if elected to the Senate, that will also be the case. But I'm very comfortable being an independent.
And you had a second question,
John? That makes perfect sense. I'm fortunate to have Henry Waxman as my congressman.
And Henry does a terrific job. I serve with Henry on the Government Reform Committee, and he has been a real bulldog on trying to expose...
Absolutely, the war profiteering. The second question is, I wonder if I could get a quick reaction from you regarding the unfolding developments in the Mideast, Israel's incursion into Lebanon vis-a-vis the Hezbollah attack on Israel.
Well, I think you can't get a quick response from me because this is, there is no quick response. This is a long and complicated and terrible issue, and it's a cycle of violence that goes on and on and on. The bottom line here is that there are no easy answers, but that the United States is going to have to exert its international influence and be a even-handed power broker to try to bring these parties together for an enduring peace. I think Clinton made a good effort. We've got to restore that and just go forward.
It's 27 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our number, 866-440-8466. Bernie's website, bernie.org. Or check out tomhartman.com for our live chat room. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it seems like the whole damn world's gone wrong. St. Joe McCarthy is dead and gone. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Don't try to change my mind with facts. To hell with the graduated income tax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
And welcome back to the radio program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't believe so. 34 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the independent from Vermont, his website, bernie.org. Check it out. If you want to drop into our live chat room, you can go to tomhartman.com. Our toll-free number, 866-440-THOM. And Charles in Kirkville, Tennessee, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Congressman Sanders, I have to know what actions we plan to take when we take back over our government to keep the government in the hands of the people instead of big business. What are we going to do about the political action committees, funding, things like that? What actions?
Okay, Charles asked a very important question. I think the implication of his question is, if I understand it correctly, is that right now we have a government which to a very large extent is owned and controlled by big money interests. It is not an accident that the Republican leadership refuses to raise the national minimum wage from above $5.15 an hour, which is the lowest level of purchasing power for the minimum wage in, I believe, 50 years or something like that. I mean, just a total outrage. While at the same time, they are prepared to outsource good-paying American jobs and provide huge tax breaks for billionaires. And on it goes, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry, making sure that we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, the credit card companies making sure that they can charge Americans 25%, 28% interest on their credit card bills. One of the answers, certainly, is that we need real campaign finance reform. And to my mind, we have got to end the absurdity by which people who have huge sums of money are able to buy politicians, or in the case of an increasing number of people, very, very wealthy people, just saying, hey, you know, I got zillions of dollars. I'm going to run for office. I'm going to try to buy an election. So I think the answer is public funding of elections. We are seeing some progress in some states, very important stuff. Arizona is making some good progress on this. Maine is making some good progress on this. A number of states are moving forward. But essentially, what we have to say is that elections cannot be bought. The second thing that we have to do is pass legislation which moves in exactly the opposite direction of what the Republicans want to do. What the Republicans are trying to do in state after state is to make it harder for working people, lower-income people, to address the reality that there are millions and millions of Americans who are not voting, that we have a relatively low voter turnout. How do we increase the voter turnout? How do we increase public discourse on the important issues? So Charles raises an important issue, but I would say real campaign finance reform. I would say getting back to the media issue that we talked about a moment ago, making sure that media talks about the real issues impacting real people's lives, that when government begins to address the health care crisis and passes national health care system, when we raise the minimum wage, when we protect workers' rights, when we demand that corporate America start reinvesting in America, not in China, I think when we do those things, people will say, you know, what government does is, in fact, important, and I've got to participate in that process.
Well said. Ken in Cincinnati, Ohio, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. Great show. This is my favorite segment. Again, Congressman Sanders, Bush just came out with the debt for last year as being $100 billion less than anticipated. It still seems awfully low, considering how much money we're spending daily in Iraq. And a second part to that question is, how soon do you think these idiots are going to try to invade Iran? Thanks. I'll listen off the air.
Well, what was interesting to me, I mean, this is the world that we live in, and the media bites on this, by the way, not all the media. The L.A. Times had a very good story. You remember last week, Tom, president had a major press conference about how good the economy is doing and what kind of success we are having in dealing with our deficit. You remember that?
Right, although he didn't.
Great, ladies and gentlemen, the deficit this year is only, was it $300 billion?
Yeah, and that doesn't count the $170 billion he's borrowing from Social Security this year.
This is good news. Good news. God, yeah. I would hate to hear the bad news.
Yeah.
What the L.A. Times correctly pointed out, they did a very good article on this, is year after year, this is what the Bush administration does. They make projections by which they say, oh, the deficit next year, we're projecting it's going to be $80 zillion, and lo and behold, it's only $40 zillion. They talk about it as good news. This goes on year after year after year. So they celebrate the good news that we only have a $300 billion deficit. And that's called spin. That's what Karl Rove does very well, and unfortunately, a lot of the media bites for it. To my mind, the fact that we have a $300 billion deficit and that we have an $8.3 trillion national debt, which equates to $27,000 for a man, woman, and child in this country, is not good news. It is a disaster, and I think we've got to stop giving huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country and to large corporations, and we've got to address this very serious problem.
Allison, Humboldt County, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Tom, I'd like to speak to Bernie.
You're live. You're on the air with him, Alice, right now.
We have all been hoping that you have found the time to read the complete RFK Jr.'s report that we sent to your office. Do you know that how really bad the Republicans cheat in elections? It needs to be stopped.
Okay. Well, this is an issue, Alice, if I understand you correctly, I think Tom and I have talked about a whole lot. And when we talk about elections, I don't think it's asking too much in our country that every single American, regardless of his or her political perspective, feels 100% confident that the vote that that person cast is going to be accurately counted. And call me a conservative, but if there are doubts about voting machines, and many of these touch screen voting machines, and there are more and more doubts being raised by a whole lot of people, then call me a conservative. I would rather, until we resolve those problems, go back to paper ballots or other tried and true methods. There should not be any anxiety among anybody. The vote is the most important aspect of our democracy, and we have to be 100%, not 99%, 100% assured that when a person's vote is cast, it is accurately counted.
Desmond in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. How are you doing?
I'm good, Desmond.
I wish you were my senator or congressman, whatever it is.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about outsourcing of jobs.
Yep.
I was looking for a part for my motor scooter yesterday, and my motor scooter is made in India. So I go to the dealership, and the guy at the dealership was a very nice guy. I've talked to him. He has a QuickBooks accounting program, I believe, in his computer, and needed some tech support. So he was directed to India, to somebody in India. So he asked about the Bajaj motor scooters, which he sells. He asked the woman there if she drove one, and she said, how do you know about it? He told her that he sold them. And then she said that nobody in India drives the scooters anymore because they have so much money now they're all driving cars. All our money is now going out of this country so somebody else can live better than us.
Well, it's not true that the people... What is happening is there are sections of India... often where a lot of outsourcing is taking place, where the people are seeing a significant increase in their standard of living, but we should not kid ourselves. They're not living better than we are. But here is the point, and Desmond makes a very, very important point. And let me just say this as strongly as I can. You have a lot of public figures out there who say, well, you know, we don't have to worry too much about them blue-collar factory jobs. Manufacturing is finished in America. Who wants to make shoes? Who wants to make TVs, assembly lines, cars? We don't have to worry about that stuff because, you know, the future of America is high-tech, it's information technology, and that's where our kids are going to be working and making good dollars. Well, anyone who observes what's going on or reads some of the recent studies understands that we may be on the cusp of losing millions, underlined millions, of good-paying information technology jobs. Desmond talks about this tech support stuff being done in India. I mean, that is happening increasingly. Airlines are using India. You have people in India who learn how to speak American. They give them American names. This, to me, is a very, very serious problem. Because if we lose blue-collar manufacturing jobs, if you lose white-collar information technology jobs, and what jobs are left for the American people? And what we begin to see is that the jobs left for our kids and grandchildren are going to be service industry jobs, working at Walmarts, working at McDonald's, and doing jobs which, by and large, do not pay living wages and do not have good benefits. And that gets back to the very first issue that you and I discussed today, Tom, and that is our trade policy and demanding that if corporate America wants us to buy products that they manufacture, if they want us to utilize services that they produce, they should do it in America and not in low-wage foreign countries.
Yeah, sounds good to me. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, his website, bernie.org. Please check it out. It's 45 minutes past the hour, 866-440-8466, our telephone number. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The only thing that changes in my mind, I never cut toe the mark, and I never go walk the line.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us on the line. Marvin in Marble Falls, Texas. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Well, good morning.
Good morning, Marvin.
I was going to ask the congressman, is there any way you could tie the minimum wage to congressional salaries and the salaries of the publicly traded companies and the nonprofit organizations should make them a multiple of minimum wage?
Well, Marvin, actually, that's a good question, because that's exactly what is happening. I think the Democratic leadership, appropriately enough, has said that if Congress wants to raise its COLA, get a COLA, that before they should do that or could do that, we've got to raise the minimum wage. And I think that that is exactly right. I mean, what we have seen in recent years is tax breaks for billionaires, Congress voting themselves COLAs, but no work on raising the minimum wage of $5.15 an hour. So if Congress wants to get a COLA, I think before they take that, they should raise the minimum wage. And that is an issue that I think the Democratic Party in Washington, I know Nancy Pelosi has been talking a whole lot about it, is united around.
COLA, of course, being a cost of living adjustment, the $3,000 more or less raise that Congress just got automatically, right?
Well, not quite automatically. You have to vote. There is a vote.
You have to vote to stop it, though, don't you?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, yeah. Winston in Redding, California.
Congressman Sanders?
Yes, Winston.
I've got a recommendation for some legislation I'd like to see passed.
Okay,
this would be that all shipping containers destined for the U.S., regardless of configuration, regardless of the country of origin, are inspected by U.S. customs officials at the time that the shipping containers are loaded at the location where they are loaded, and that they are then secured before they are shipped to the U.S.
Well, I agree with you, Winston. I mean, I'm not exactly sure about the best way to do it, but you raise a real concern, and I think your idea is a very good idea. There is a growing understanding in this country that one of the vulnerabilities that we have for a terrorist attack is through our ports and through the lack of effective inspection of these containers. So I think you're right on the money, and I think there are many of us in Congress who want to move in exactly that direction.
Joji in Tacoma, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, let's see, I'm a student and I'm an activist, and I'll be a nurse in several years. And I'm interested in labor activism, and I'm interested in protesting the Oman trade proposal, which you were talking about. And I'm wondering when the House vote is coming up on it, and whether or not that specific thing, that specific proposal, is something that you think could benefit from on the street organizing.
It hasn't. The vote hasn't been scheduled.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has passed. Jesse, it's passed the Senate. I suspect that it will come before the House in the not-too-distant future. I don't know exactly when it will.
Mm-hmm.
Do I believe that we will benefit from grassroots organizing around this issue? Absolutely and positively.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's imperative that we expose the disastrous nature of these unfettered trade agreements and their impact on working Americans. So any help that you and others can give us on that would be very greatly appreciated.
Well, thank you. I mean, I really think that we have a better chance of putting people on the street using labor issues rather than, you know, the students aren't very organized. They mostly try to go for peace demonstrations. You know,
right.
They ask questions like, is it right to work with organized labor? Is that really in our interest? And I think, you know, if we had more contact, you know, Tom was saying, Tom hadn't even heard of this. You know, we have no forewarning system. We have no, we don't hear about these disastrous proposals before they're going to happen.
No, you're absolutely correct. And it is very important for young people and for activists to be working closely with unions and other working organizations, because that's where the action is. The American worker today, the middle class, is under great stress, and it's important that we go out and help educate and organize those people so that we do not continue to see a decline in the standard of living of our country, and especially working people. So I would urge you to go out organize, knock on doors, and educate.
And contact your member of Congress as well.
Absolutely.
Gene in Nashville, Tennessee, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, is this me?
Yep.
There's an issue, there's a thing in the paper here today that caught my attention, and I was listening to you talking about campaign finance reform, which I totally support. That should happen. I don't know how it's ever going to come around, but this article in the paper today mentions that former President Clinton is going to be in Nashville on August 4th to help raise funds for Harold Ford Jr., who's running for Frist's Senate seat. And Ford Jr. has a very good chance at this, and I support him, and, you know, that needs to happen. But the article mentions there's going to be three events in Nashville on August 4th. One event...
Gene, I'm sorry, we only have a minute left before the end of the show.
Okay, I'll be quick. This is totally in control of the Democrats, the Democratic Party. One event costs $10,000 per couple. The second event costs $1,000 per person. And the third event is to be held in the Titans football stadium, and it's $150 per person, which... All of these exclude me. I would love to be there. I'd love to participate, and I can't go to any of these.
Well, you raise a very good issue. I am supporting Harold Ford as well. We certainly could use him, very bright young man, and we could use him in the U.S. Senate. The dilemma that he faces and all candidates face is the need to raise substantial sums of money, and you're looking at a manifestation of that right there. That is very unfortunate.
Yeah, the problem isn't so much, you know, what Clinton and Ford are doing as the system in which they're doing it.
Correct.
We have to, you know, I mean, I say to them, good luck. I hope they're very successful in raising the money
but
they need.
It is unfortunate that people cannot come and hear the former president speak for free.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of the things I always respected about you, Bernie, the 10 years that I lived in Vermont. I showed up at several of your events long before you and I actually knew each other, and it was always just, hey, come on in, you know? It's remarkable. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org is website. Bernie, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be with you. Bye-bye.
57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, streaming live all across the planet, and also on CRN Digital on cable TV systems in 29 states. John W. Dean is with us. He has a new book out, Conservatives Without Conscience. He's the author of the national bestseller, Worse Than Watergate. In fact, when that book came out, it was the last time we spoke. John Dean, glad to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure to be with you again.
This is an extraordinary piece of work. I almost probably don't have to say it. John Dean, the former counsel to Richard Nixon, a Watergate figure, and not sure how you would most prefer to be described in that context. But the book that you've written, exploring the roots of not just the modern conservative movement, but how it has taken this authoritarian bend. First of all, let me just, in 1964, you talk about Barry Goldwater in the book. In 1964, I was 13 years old, and I went door to door for Barry Goldwater.
Did you?
My father was the chairman of the Republican Party in the county that we lived in Michigan, and I was very into it. I had read John Stormer's None Dare Call It Treason. I'd read J. Edgar Hoover's book that you referenced, you know, The Masters of Deceit. I was just gung-ho. And within 3 years, you know, I was on a college campus and looking at the Vietnam War, and it completely transformed my vision of politics, and I went from being a conservative to being whatever I call myself a progressive today. And I'm
curious if Goldwater would have won, it might have been a lot better for the country than Johnson pursuing and escalating that war.
I don't disagree with you. And in fact, 2 years ago, I went back and I reread No Apologies, Goldwater's second autobiography. And it was clear to me that he was blinded by his fear of communism to the point that it didn't allow him to see the horrible mistake he was making, for example, in opposing the civil rights movement, because he thought King had been infiltrated by the communists. But beyond that, he was a good man with a reasonable vision for America. You portray in your book the classic kind of Goldwater conservatives. In fact, you dedicate the book to Barry Goldwater, as I recall.
I do.
And I'm curious, how would you portray liberalism? Because I want to get into the whole thing about authoritarianism and everything else that's in the book, but this is something that I didn't get out of the book in reading through. Maybe I just missed it, but it seems to me that the liberal worldview is really the one that came out of the Enlightenment, that, you know, George Washington said that he was a liberal. He hoped America ever become more liberal. How is that different from the type of conservatism that you applaud in the book?
Well, I think if you track what I did and show how I try to show in the roots of conservatism when the intellectual movement started, they really corrupted the basic documents of the founding of the country and called them conservative documents when they were truly classic liberal documents. And Barry Goldwater, for one, has often said that when people look back on his era and his thoughts and his philosophy, they would call him a liberal, which is kind of curious. Liberalism runs throughout the book. I actually put a footnote in at one point to note really probably the greatest distinction between contemporary liberalism and conservatism resides in equality. The liberal still is very much for equality. Conservatives really don't give a hoot about equality. And that's the interesting thing. I had some conversation with the senator about that also. He said, well, yes, those are the guys who don't, you know, the conservatives who don't care about equality are the ones who don't get elected. That was once true. I'm not so sure it's true anymore.
Well, in the book, you quote Russell Kirk, and I've read The Conservative Mind, and Kirk, of course, bases that book, the whole entire first chapter is about Sir Edmund Burke. And Kirk talks about how conservatives, in classic conservatism, you have classes and orders rather than equality. Burke said, you know, it does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in as servile a profession as a hairdresser or a tallow maker, candle maker, but it does society considerable violence if such a man is allowed to participate in governance, in other words, to vote.
Fairly elitist view, I'd say.
It is, but William F. Buckley read, you know, The Conservative Mind and said, yeah, that's me. Even Barry Goldwater did.
Well, actually, you know, he didn't. Goldwater, I'll tell you the greatest influence on Goldwater was probably Herbert Hoover. He was a collector of all of Hoover's works. He got to know him after he got in the Senate, and if he had an intellectual mentor, that was it, because the senator had not been much of a student until he really got to Washington. That he spent the first 10 years in the Senate really steeping himself in this stuff. And I never thought him as a Burkean by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, and in fact, in the book, you talk about a conversation that you had with Barry Goldwater in his last days. Do you mind sharing that with us? That was a great moment there, where you're talking to him about. You said I called Senator Goldwater to only recently learn more about Chuck Colson's involvement with Silent Coup.
Oh yeah, when we're talking about Liddy.
Yeah, and just the whole Christian conservative, takeover.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm not sure exactly which conversation you're referring to, because I actually footnote several of them in there. But the senator and I really, he was miffed and mystified. I was mystified as to what had happened to conservatism. And that's where, in 1994, this is where this book really started. And then originally we were going to co-author it, because he said, let's go out and find the answers. He said, I've got contacts, you've got contacts, I got papers, you've got papers, let's put it all together and see if we can figure this riddle out. I said, fine, I'm for it. Unfortunately, his health wasn't very good, and I could see the book was going to be a burden on him, so I said, let's put this on the shelf till you're feeling better. He said, fine, we'll do that, but let's not drop it. And unfortunately, he never did get healthier, and when he passed away, I said, I'm just not going to drop this project.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, did find the answers.
Yeah, well, this is the conversation where he said, I'm concerned that the Republican Party is selling out its soul.
Selling the soul to the religious right. He was very deeply concerned about that. He thought the religious right was highly divisive. He said, John, I've dealt with these people for years. While I respect their thinking and their beliefs, they just can't fit and understand the way government works. They are unyielding. They believe that they have the imprimatur of God in implementing their policies, and they will not compromise on those policies and beliefs. And he said it just makes an impossible situation because government is a process of, and politics is a process of compromise. This troubled him deeply that they were, slowly gaining increasing control of the Republican Party.
You talk in the book about Stanley Milgram's work, and in the book you say when Milgram invited me to speak at his conference, I thought he was dead.
Not then. He was very much alive when I met him.
This was
back in 1976, though. He did die prematurely. And Bob Altmaier, who I also mentioned in the book, says, without question, Milgram was probably one of the greatest social scientists this country's ever seen, underappreciated, groundbreaking stuff he did.
Yeah, these were the famous experiments where he ordered people, had people in white coats ordering people to give electric shocks to other people, all the way up to the point where they thought they might be at risk of killing the other person, and 65% of ordinary people were willing to do that.
They were people solicited off the streets of New Haven, and they came in and they were in this lab setting that had sort of the aura of science about it, and an authority figure was giving them directions. Of course, the learner who they were shocking, who was given a little jolt every time they failed to remember word pairs, was actually an actor who was in on this experiment, and the person who was being tested was the person who was giving the jolts of electricity to see how far the authority figure could push them, and they pushed them to the 450 volts on regular basis,
right.
Which is, and then with the other person, the acting learner, screaming often. Yet these people, and Milgram makes a very interesting, I looked at this because I was trying to understand how do people who work at the CIA and know that they're part of a system that is torturing people in the Eastern European secret prisons, and they're supporting that system, they're providing information or bringing it out of it. How do they do that every day? How do the people who work at NSA, who are turning that huge electronic apparatus of surveillance on their neighbors and their friends, where's their conscience? And then I realized this is a perfect example of the Milgram experiment at work. They're under authority figures. What they're doing is they haven't lost their conscience. They have given their conscience to another agent, and so they feel very comfortable in doing it.
We're talking with John W. Dean, author of, first of all, Worse Than Watergate, a brilliant book. His new one, Conservatives Without Conscience. Sir, you can stick around over the break. We can talk a little bit more?
Sure can.
Great, because I'd like to follow through on this whole authoritarian personality. It's an absolutely brilliant book. You've got to read this book, Conservatives Without Conscience. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve somebody.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with John Dean, White House legal counsel to President Nixon for 1,000 days, also served as chief minority counsel for the House Judiciary Committee, associate deputy attorney general in the U.S. Department of Justice, the author of Worse Than Watergate, Blind Ambition, Lost Honor, The Rehnquist Choice, Warren G. Harding, and his new book, Conservatives Without Conscience. John Dean, the little bump there, bumper music from Bob Dylan's brief flirtation with fundamentalist Christianity, you're going to have to serve somebody, really kind of encapsulates the personality that you're talking about in these conservatives without conscience. Not to put the point on Bob Dylan, but the idea of a dominance and submission.
Absolutely. When the religious right became increasingly active in conservative politics, that's when I really see the growth of authoritarianism within the movement. Authoritarianism breaks down into two segments. You have leaders, of course, but the bulk are the followers. Most of the scientific work over the years, for about the last 50 years, has been done on the followers, and only in the last 10 years on the leaders. But we have this amazing body of empirical evidence developed by largely through anonymous testing of people to get their reactions and explanations of their behavior. The religious right constantly scores very high on authoritarian scales.
Now, one of the things that you suggest in the book is that submissive authoritarian behavior, those people who were the good Germans, shall we say, back in the 30s, that can be evoked from people who might not otherwise normally display that if they find themselves in an environment with a powerful authoritarian leader, and particularly if that's in combination with an environment where they experience fear, anxiety.
Absolutely. In fact, there was data on that before 9/11. There's new data post 9/11 that shows large numbers of people, because of fear, became active in the Republican Party and became active in the conservative movement because they found comfort and security and a feeling of safety under authoritarian leadership. So it's been demonstrated lately, and of course what the Bush people discovered, they either found this from their own polling or social scientists tipped them off, it became a very effective political tool. They have been fear-mongering ever since 9/11, trying to keep the base in line and grow the ranks, and it's worked.
The Republican Party has been playing this like a fiddle, and in a way they're actually increasing the number of authoritarian followers in the United States by bringing this out in people.
Absolutely true. One of the reasons I did this book is there's about the hardcore right now is about 23% that would follow an authority anywhere that authority took them. There are obviously more than that, because it takes more than that to win control of the White House, for example. But you have that hardcore, but that number is constantly increasing, and the fear-mongering is one of the contributing factors.
So what do we do about that?
I think the answer is to be aware of it. A lot of people, for example, in the area of what frightens them, they really don't think about how this is really playing right into the hands of terrorists. And they don't look at the statistical realities of terrorism. They just react to it viscerally and don't look at the fact that there are more drownings in the United States every year than there are likely to be anybody killed from a terrorist.
Yeah,
there
are
more
industrial
accidents, drunk drivers. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a whole host of things that are much more threatening to our lives than terrorism. The Cold War and nuclear annihilation was certainly much more threatening than the worst of the terrorists.
Yeah.
Even let's say a worst case with someone got one or two WMDs. It's not the same as the Soviet Union getting ready to wipe us off the face of the planet.
And yet we have, and we only have about a minute and a half left here, I'm sorry, but we have a media that is completely driven by getting eyeballs, by ratings. And, if it bleeds, it leads. What do we do in a media environment like this where we get infotainment instead of news? How do we change that?
Well, I think somewhat the Internet is changing that. People are able to get out and get more information independently. Obviously, readers and books are a help. But the great middle of America and the center is part of our nation, if they're sleeping, the danger is that this extremism on the right is going to keep creeping, and that's proto-fascist conduct. And we're not on that road yet, but we're so dangerously close to it that we have to be very careful.
Do you think? I mean, there's
and I'm no alarmist. Believe me.
I understand. These folks, the ends justify the means. Stealing elections. I mean, is this a very real risk?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Vigilance is the only way that that we are all protected. And there's a wonderful, you know, there's a wonderful yin-yang in our system, and hopefully the pendulum will swing.
Yeah, hopefully. John W. Dean, the book Conservatives Without Conscience. Sir, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
And for writing this brilliant book.
Thank you.
It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I wouldn't screw up the environment or the money for retirement like the liberals complain. I'd impress all my poo-pooers, shocking all the evildoers if I only had a brain. Now I'd pronunciate much better, honor liberties to the letter for the folks that we detain. And when the world called me a fatty, I wouldn't run off to my daddy if I only had a brain.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Over at one of the Rapture Ready websites, one of the blogs. In fact, it's called Rapture Ready. It's the blog, rr-bb.com, the website. Oh, happy day, the title of the thread. Is it time to get excited? I can't help the way I feel for the first time in my Christian walk. I have no doubt that the day of the Lord's appearing is upon us. The war in the Middle East. There are people in this government, in this administration, who believe that war in the Middle East is a good thing because it will cause Jesus to return to earth. Or the post-millennialists, that it'll cause the beginning of the 1,000 years that will end with Jesus returning to earth. The big debate between the pre-millennialists and the post-millennialists, but nonetheless, that, you know, in their mind, it's a good thing. And this is truly, truly spooky. And speaking of that crowd broadly, the fundamentalist cult within mainstream Christianity, well, it's outside of mainstream Christianity, actually, the fundamentalist cult in Christianity, Ralph Reed, his primary a week away. GQ, Gentleman Quarterly, I think it used to be called, maybe it's just called GQ now, I'm not sure. The new magazine has a piece out, this over at tpmmuckraker.com, the website. They say in advance of its August publication day, GQ has released a big piece on Ralph Reed today with one gem in particular, a plan hatched by Reed and Jack Abramoff, which sounds suspiciously like mortgaging old black people, as a former Reed associate told the magazine. No, I'm not kidding. Now, by the way, at the same time, in today's Wall Street Journal, an article about how Ralph Reed has raised $2.5 million for his run for Attorney General for Georgia. And the Wall Street Journal notes, Reed counts on potent turnout operations. Well, you know, of course, he's got all these churches on his side. Well, here's how it worked. Back in the day, back a few years back, Jack Abramoff came up with this scheme, and it was really a variation on the old Walmart employee scheme where various large corporations, it was called, you know, dead worker insurance. They would take out insurance, particularly companies that hired a lot of elderly people or older people, or not even necessarily elderly or older, let's say over 50 people, over age 50. With the Walmart greeters and whatnot, they would take out life insurance policies on them, make themselves the beneficiary. The corporation would take out the policy, it would make itself the beneficiary, and not tell the person that they'd taken out the life insurance policy. When the person dies, then the corporation makes a whole pile of money. And, you know, this got outed back 3-4 years ago, and I think much of corporate America has stopped doing it because it was just viewed by so many people as just repugnant. Although there are, as far as I know, there are still corporations that are doing this. There have been, you know, efforts to legislate against it, which have been largely unsuccessful. So anyhow, Jack Abramoff came up with an idea very similar to this. He went to the Tigua tribe, a Texas Native American tribe, a rather poor tribe. They didn't have a big fancy casino. And he said, you know, you want to hire me as a lobbyist? Let's set up a deal where every Tigua, every Indian in this tribe, every Native American in this tribe who's 75 years old or older, I'll buy a life insurance policy on them. I'll be the beneficiary of that life insurance policy. I'll pay for the life insurance policy. It's not going to cost you anything. But I get paid off when they die. And then that will be the way that you can hire me. I'll be paid that way. Right? And it was the dead Indian policy scheme that Jack Abramoff came up with. Well, the Tigua turned him down. They said, that's no. Give me a break. But Ralph Reed, apparently, and Jack Abramoff thought, you know, this is a pretty good idea. If the Tigua don't want to go for it, maybe Ralph Reed's connections with the Christian churches in Georgia, particularly the black churches, where you have higher mortality rates, people are more likely, African-Americans, more likely to have heart disease, more likely to have hypertension, strokes, more likely to die at an early age. Let's do this thing with some of the black churches down there. This from Jack Abramoff's email to Ralph Reed. Quote, per our previous discussion, let me know how we can move forward to chat with folks who can set this up with African-American elders. It can be huge. Thanks. Attached to it was a document titled Charity Elder Program 2.doc. 3 days later, Ralph Reed replies. He says, yes, it looks interesting. I assume you'll set up a meeting in D.C. as a next step or whatever we should do next. Let me know. The article continues to point out, Reed would have been the point man with the church leaders, one assumes, ushering them through the sticky process of getting all of their elders to sign up for life insurance policies payable to Jack Abramoff and Ralph Reed. Amazing. And, you know, the Republicans gung-ho behind this guy. It's as John Dean points out, These people are not conservative, and they don't have a conscience. I mean, that's just what it comes down to. There's no other way to summarize it. The Bank of Japan just raised their interest rates. Now, I've been reading in the press for, a week or two, everybody's been speculating about the Bank of Japan is going to raise interest rates. The Bank of Japan is sort of like the Fed here in the United States. And they define the interest rates that of interbank loans that then echo down to be the interest rates for everything from credit cards to mortgages to everything else. Although Japan is not as heavily a credit-dependent society as the United States. And there's been all this rumbling going on among economic circles and in the more esoteric economic press that I've been reading for the last month or so, actually, I would say, maybe even a little longer, about what's going to happen if and or when the Bank of Japan raises interest rates, because they've been at essentially zero for about 10 years, Japan trying to prevent basically an economic meltdown. They were very concerned that the yen was deflating, that they were looking at a scenario like the U.S. Great Depression. Not quite so serious, but a deflationary situation where currency becomes actually worth more, but there's less of it around. And so in order to solve that problem, they dropped interest rates to zero. So as to make money very available, increase liquidity, more people will borrow at those low rates. They will then spend that money. That will get money moving through the economy. That will create demand, which will create more manufacturing and the cycle, you know, on the cycle goes, a way of stimulating the economy. They've been doing this for 10 years. For all practical purposes, well, I guess 5 years it's been at zero. For 10 years it's been very, very low. And I didn't quite understand exactly why Japan raising its interest rate should worry me, or should concern me, let's say. I could understand where it might concern the Japanese, but why me? You know, here I am in the United States. Why you? Well, today there is an article in the Wall Street Journal by Yuka Hayashi, about this. The title is Bank of Japan Lifts Interest Rates. Subtitle, Quarter Point Increase from Historic Low of Zero Highlights Economic Recovery. And there was a sentence in here that just set off the light bulb in my head, and I'm sure will for you as well. Two sentences. The build-up to the rate increase was closely watched by global financial markets. This is what I'm telling you. Everybody's been going, oh, what's the Bank of Japan going to do? And again, I'm like, well, you know, why are we all worried about that? Well, here it is. Before this year's world stock price declines, Japan's zero-rate regime had contributed to global bull markets in everything from high-yield bonds to stocks. Say what? The U.S. stock market has been going up because Japan's interest rates are at zero? The Spanish stock market, the British stock market have been going up because, and the bond markets have been going up because Japan's interest rates are at zero. Why would that be? Well, as they say, to finish the sentence here in the Wall Street Journal, Japanese investors looked overseas for better returns. In other words, Japanese sitting, I mean, this is the second largest economy in the world. They're investing here, which boosts our economy, because they can get higher rates of return here, buying, for example, U.S. bonds. And then they continue. While international speculators, such as hedge funds, which could be based here in the United States, borrowed money at Japan's low rates and then bought other assets. And that's when the light bulb went off. It's like, okay, I've got a hedge fund here in the United States. I'm sitting on $50 billion. What do? I borrow another $50 billion in Japan at zero interest rate. That's actually not zero. I mean, you know, it gets jacked up a little bit. Say I'm borrowing at 1% annual interest rate. And then I take that money and I buy U.S. treasuries that are paying 4%. At the end of the year, I pay off the loan in Japan. I get my money from the treasuries. I just made 3%. Guaranteed, no risk. Or I take that money and I put it in the stock market, or I buy gold or something like that, any kind of investment. People were borrowing money like crazy in Japan, even from outside Japan, because the interest rates were so low. Well, the interest rates go up, the amount of money for borrowing goes down, which means that international liquidity goes down. And sure enough, the Dow dropped another, it's down 108 points right now, dropped again today. So it's fascinating how this stuff shakes out. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I care not for the polar bear. I hate the caribou. I love the sound of gushing wells and black gold bubbling through. Halibut, halibut.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour on the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Just to summarize this thing about the Japanese interest rates going up, it's Japan's interest rate, because Japan is such a large economy, one of the three largest economies in the world, the United States, Germany, and Japan, the three largest, and I believe Japan is number two, it may be number three. I'd have to, you know, track that one down. But because their economy is so large, and because there are so many yen in circulation, and the yen is so available as an international currency, the interest rates being very, very low has meant that people can borrow in yen at a very, very low interest rate, invest that money, and, you know, if there's any return at all of consequence, anything more than a point or two, have essentially a guaranteed return on investment as long as the yen itself was remaining stable. And so what has been happening is that over the last decade, a lot of the liquidity in the world, a lot of the money floating around, a lot of the free money flowing around that has allowed stock markets to rise or caused stock markets to rise and bond markets as well, and held down in many cases the prices of some commodities, has has been fueled by this, you know, cheap money coming out of Japan. As Japan starts raising their interest rates, and at the same time the United States is raising their interest rates, now there's talk about the Bank of England's going to raise interest rates, what that does is it sucks money out of the general economy. You suck money out of the economy, there's less money to invest, there's less money for the people, the professional investors, the people who just play with money for a living out there to play with. And equity markets, stocks and bond, both stocks and bonds, start going down, and people who have their retirements in savings accounts, 501k, 401ks, for example, as opposed to pensions, people who have defined contribution plans like 401ks, are going to see their retirement value being reduced. We could see a significant downturn in the U.S. economy and the worldwide economy, and slide into, if this at the same time that the U.S. is having to inflate its currency in order to pay off the enormous debts that George W. Bush is running up, could be sliding into or back into the stagflation like we had in the 70s after, as a consequence of all the borrowing and spending that went on with the Vietnam War. I mean, it's just like all over again. And then, you know, Japan is a double whammy, and I think that's one of the reasons that worldwide markets are freaking out a little bit. 53 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. William in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, William, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tim. I think I take some exception to John Dean's comparing present-day Republicans with past Republicans.
Well, what he's saying is that they're very different, and although I think he's being rather selective about that, he's not remembering Gene McCarthy, although he talks about him in the book, actually.
Well, exactly. I mean, yeah, the Republicans are the party of Joe McCarthy and the Red Scare. I mean, the whole New Deal program was accused of being communist by the Republicans.
Right.
And Democrats were accused of being soft on communism. They used fear back then. They're just using it again today.
Yeah, if you read his book, he starts right out by saying that the modern Republican Party pretty much came out of the guys who were left behind when Teddy Roosevelt went off to start the Bull Moose Party and didn't want to follow him, didn't want to stay progressive. I actually wrote an op-ed that you can find if you go to tomhartman.com and click Articles on Democracy. I wrote it about 2 years ago called Republicans, Please Take Back Your Party. If you go back to the 1884 or 1886 Republican Party platform, it was incredibly progressive. I mean, the Republican Party that was started in 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, that became the party, you know, Lincoln was their first major presidential candidate. From 1856 to 1886, more or less, for about, what would that be, 30 years, it was the progressive party, standing against the Democratic Party of Thomas Jefferson that had become the party of slavery and a fairly regressive party. But by the mid-1880s, the Republican Party had been bought out by the railroad robber barons, you know, Huntington and Jay Gould and these guys, and become corrupted. And Teddy Roosevelt tried to blow back against that after McKinley died and he became president, but it didn't work. And the Republicans essentially threw Roosevelt out, and he started the Bull Moose Party. And what we're left over with, as you correctly point out, are these guys who are really not conservatives. They're reactionaries, I would say.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Good
right.
point, William. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Glenn.
Hi, Tom. I was thinking back to a study that was going around before the last election, political conservative as motivated social cognition, and it talks about the study about conservatism and fascism began in 1950, this Ordano Frankel Brunswick study,
yeah.
Where they were, you know, and I was wondering if Dean talks about that study as a part of his book, since you've read it and I've only ordered it, and also, you know, when you bring up Dean to conservatives, they dismiss him as, you know, he's turned into a left-wing nutcase, and I see him as a man of conscience who didn't like his president committing crimes against the Constitution.
Yeah, first of all, Dean is that particular study. I'm not sure. I haven't memorized his book, and I haven't literally read every word of it. I've probably read a third of it, you know, sprinkling through it. But he does. I'd say half the book is devoted to the science of the authoritarian personality, the science of how fascism arises at the level of the individual rather than at the level of society. And then he goes into the level of society. It is a really important book for that reason. And, I, you know, the one thing that concerns me is that is that, you know, he's going out saying, I'm a Barry Goldwater conservative. Well, you have to read the book to figure out that what he really means by that is basically he's a liberal.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's just, you know, it's just fascinating how these terms are all twisted around. Glenn, thanks for the call.
Okay, Tom.
Good to hear from you. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, no, actually, we'll take a clean election. We'll just, that's fine. Just a clean election. That's all we want.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. The situation with and around Israel in the Middle East is, as you know, heating up, and heating up rather dramatically. And I want to comment on this. I want to share some thoughts with you about it that go beyond the normal analysis. Whose fault is it? Whose side are you on? Is it, you know, is it the Israelis? Is it the Palestinians? Is it Hamas? Is it Hezbollah? Is it, you know, this sort of thing? What's going on? I think that there's a bigger picture here that is being missed by the majority of Americans, is probably being missed by most citizens of the world, although I can't say for sure. I haven't in the last 24 hours read that much international press. But the thing that causes that brought me to this conclusion that I'm going to share with you in just a minute about what's really going on here really started last night about midnight. I woke up about, I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to do this radio, to start prep for this radio program and the one that precedes it that I do locally here in Portland. And I woke up around midnight. I just couldn't get back to sleep. So for 3 hours, I laid in bed and read the letters of Osama bin Laden, there's a book out. It's called Message to the World, The Letters of Osama bin Laden, and it's the compiled letters of bin Laden, along with a brief biography of him. It's not congratulatory or laudatory. It's a look into the mind of what some would say a madman, some would say a sociopath, some would say an evil genius, whatever. And Osama bin Laden's mentor, he had two mentors, Ayman al-Zarqawi and a fellow whose first name I'm forgetting, but his last name was Qutb, Q-U-T-B, as I recall. Now, Qutb's brother was also named Qutb, and I forget his first name too, but he was the founder of the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt back in the 1950s. And he had lived in the United States. This guy lived in the United States. He lived in Colorado, as I recall, near Golden, Colorado, and near where Coors is, actually. And in the 50s and 60s, he was watching America, in his mind, melt down. And he thought that this was, you know, this horrible meltdown in America, this madness that was the result of an emerging middle class in the United States, a strong middle class that was the result of strong labor unions and strong protection of our domestic industries by tariffs, and which had 35% in the 1950s, 35% of the American workforce had a union job, which means 70% of Americans had good pay, health insurance, retirement pension, They could send their kids through college. I mean, this was the generation that graduated from high school that was producing a generation that was going to graduate from college, kind of thing. You know, it was one of the great leaps in American society. And the side effect of all this wealth in the United States in the 50s and 60s, the side effect of this great middle class, was that people felt secure enough to freely participate in civil government and freely participate in public discourse. And so you had African Americans saying, hey, you know, we'd like those rights you guys talked about 100 years ago. You had women coming out and saying, we would like equality in the workplace. You had students speaking up and speaking out and saying, you know, we think the war in Vietnam is wrong. I mean, that came a little farther down the road, but the Elvis Presley, even rock and roll, you know, students saying, yeah, we're not gonna be the nice little ticky tacky the way it's always been. And here in the United States, you had the founder of the neoconservative movement, Leo Strauss, looking at this thing, going, this is bad news. This is a society melting down. And that led directly to Paul Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush and the whole thing. And you had this guy, Kitaib, looking at it, going, this is terrible. We cannot allow something like this. If this is what democracy is all about, if this is what Western values are all about, this is wrong. We cannot allow this to happen in the Middle East. And he went back to Egypt and founded the Muslim Brotherhood and tried to assassinate Nasser. Nasser had him arrested, had him tortured, and murdered. His student was an Afghan pediatrician by the name of Ayman al-Zarqawi. Or Zawahiri? I don't have any of this written out in front of me. I'm sorry. I'm doing this all from memory from having read this thing half the night. So, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the guy that's referred to as the number two guy to Osama bin Laden so often. He was actually the student of Kitaib. And he and Kitaib's brother, also named Kitaib, were the mentors of Osama bin Laden, who was in his 20s. He was 23 years old, as I recall, when he first went to Afghanistan. He was 32 or 33 or 34. He was in his early 30s after he successfully overthrew the Soviet Union, went back to Saudi Arabia, and following the Muslim Brotherhood ideals of trying to create a society that was extremely conservative, where women were completely controlled, where everybody was completely controlled. You know, this fascistic mindset that John Dean was talking about earlier. Osama bin Laden goes back to Saudi Arabia, and he sees the Saudi royal family as being corrupt. You know, they're in the pocket with Bush Sr. and the Carlyle Group and all this. And even worse, the bordering country, the country that they share probably the largest border with, Iraq, has Saddam Hussein, who has declared Iraq as the only secular state in the Middle East, with no religion in government. Well, this is intolerable. Saddam Hussein is letting women participate. They're going to schools. There are women doctors. The women are walking around with their elbows showing and their heads uncovered. This is intolerable. Osama bin Laden gathers together a bunch of his, you know, merry band. They had this center, this kind of nerve center, communication center that was referred to as the base, which is in Arabic Al-Qaeda. And they were going to go invade Iraq from Saudi Arabia. And the Saudi royal family said, no, you're not. And deported him, stripped him of his citizenship, and deported him to the Sudan at the age of 30-something, 32, 33, 34, Osama bin Laden. So by the way, the Muslim extremists who are taking over Sudan right now, as we speak, you know, this whole thing, the ginger weed, they're the students of Osama bin Laden when he was in Sudan. So what you have is bin Laden then wanting to get the attention of the West in order to cause us to overreact to him. Right? Bin Laden wants us to overreact to him. so that he can point to us and say, see, these guys are the enemy, so that the Arab states and or at the level of the individual, so that Muslims throughout the Arab world will rally around him, because he only had a couple thousand followers at the most, and a lot of them were just hangers-on because the guy was a multimillionaire. And so he starts, you know, throwing bombs at us, basically, you know, blowing us up in Lebanon and blowing up this ship and going after this, that, and the other thing. And Clinton wasn't having it, wasn't going to turn the guy into a hero. What he needed, what he desperately needed to become, to galvanize this force, was an overreaction by the United States, which is exactly what he got when George Bush became president. Now, to bring this to Israel and the situation in Israel, a couple of months ago, in Lebanon, in Beirut, in downtown Beirut, there was a meeting of all the political factions in Lebanon. Lebanon is essentially a democracy right now. And one of the subjects on the table was, how do we disarm Hezbollah? Hezbollah, a group, arguably a terrorist group inside Lebanon, how do we get the weapons away from them? Hezbollah finds out about this, and they say, you know, we can't allow this to happen. At the same time, you've got Hamas, you know, coming to power in Palestine and in the Palestinian territories, and similarly, there's this discussion among the old Yasser Arafat guys about, you know, how do we disarm Hamas? So for both Hezbollah and Hamas, the easy solution is let's pick a fight with Israel, and if we can get them to overreact or just to react really harshly, it's going to so radicalize the region that we're going to get members, and it's going to prevent the Lebanese from disarming us. And that's what I think is going on there. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Tuesday in November, I took that stroll to cast my ballot at the local poll. The lines were long, but I didn't care. I had a water, a hat, and my folding chair. Walked up to the booth, didn't say a word. Sure that my voice would be heard. Hit that button, my vote was sent. But now nobody knows exactly where it went. They lost my vote, it isn't fair. I took a stand, but did anybody care? Then lost my vote, now do you know where did my ballot go?
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Our number will be getting to your calls in just a minute. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS for all things iPod, Macintosh, etc. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is with us in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Hi. The president talked to Jordan's King Abdullah, the prime minister of Lebanon, Mubarak of Egypt, and then today Tony Snow in Russia was crowing about the, and actually I think it's probably not a bad thing, about the Saudis saying that the uncalculated adventures undertaken by elements in Lebanon without recourse to legal authority and without consulting and coordinating with Arab nations is what they had to really say about Hezbollah.
Now, I was just talking about this, and I was just giving my take on this, and what it kind of boils down to is this. Lebanon was preparing to disarm Hezbollah, and there was a meeting just a few months ago in downtown Beirut of literally all the political factions in the Lebanese democracy and the government. And the subject of the meeting was how to disarm Hezbollah. You have, at the same time, Hamas is coming under pressure from the Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement and others to disarm and to no longer be a terrorist organization, but rather to be a, you know, whatever, a political party or something, to become like, you know, the IRA in Ireland, arguably. It's a bad analogy, but I don't have a better one. And both of these organizations, in order to galvanize their fundamentalist right-wing, to galvanize the street, to galvanize the base, and hang on to the political power that they have, that in many ways comes out of the barrel of a gun, to badly paraphrase Mao. Both of them have chosen to attack Israel in the hopes that Israel would attack back in a way that would radicalize the Middle East. And Israel then is stuck with this horrible decision. Do we do the pacifist route, the Gandhi route, and play the victim on this thing, or have a minimal response and hope that the Lebanese will deal with Hezbollah and Syria and whatnot will deal with Hamas, or do we strike with an absolute iron fist, knowing that it's going to radicalize the region, but hope that we can strike enough terror in these people that they will actually lose support on the street? And what do you think?
I like your analysis. I think what's interesting is when they don't even get the Saudis coming out in their favor, they have lost definitely some chits on this.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think that in particular with Hezbollah, that this was a calculated political move by them to maintain power. This is in an otherwise democratic state, Lebanon. I mean, there's this old axiom that in 200 years of democracy in the world, no two democracies have ever gone to war with each other. Well, here we have, Lebanon and Israel, two democracies fighting each other. Well, I would argue that it's not. It's actually Israel versus Hezbollah. And Lebanon's going, hey, please, not here, And they were just about to say that and have been saying it, actually, in progressively louder and stronger ways to Hezbollah to begin with. So I view this as really these two organizations, these two quasi-political organizations. I think to call them terrorist organizations is to caricature them, to, create cartoon characters out of them. It's far more complex and subtle than that.
Well, I agree. It's very complicated, and so is their relationship with Lebanon.
Yes.
Now, there's something that just came up that I just found out about, and that it has been reported through sort of a source of U.S. news called White House Bulletin. And they are now saying that there is a situation in Iraq where there has been forced migration out of some of the areas in Baghdad, up to tens of thousands of people into other areas in Iraq and some into Syria.
The ethnic cleansing is beginning?
It certainly sounds like it.
Yeah.
And my guess is that is going to be something to watch, because I have checked every other site, I have checked every other thing, and nobody is yet reporting it.
Yeah. Now, I recall where Zbigniew Brzezinski on NPR recently, he was talking to Scott Simon, and he said that at some point the administration needs to do what Jack Murtha said to do, it needs to redeploy, pull out, and maybe even break up the country like Biden says. And a senior administration official said to Brzezinski, we fully intend to do that. We're simply going to call it victory and do it around an election.
Exactly. Also, I don't know if you saw this, but the Congressional Budget Office yesterday afternoon set their war-related costs at $432 billion since 2001.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. It's enough to educate every college student in the United States for 4 years.
And Iraq War, $290 billion alone.
Yeah. Ellen Ratner, thank you, Ellen. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great talking with you, Ellen. 27 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman program. Tom Hartman, we appear to be having a bit of a technical problem right now. I'll be back live with you in just a few minutes, but for the moment, just hang on and enjoy this music.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Looking down the nose of what people say. These words and words will be. It's what you do and not what you say. You're not part of the future, then get out of the way.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Peter Phillips with us. Project Censored. Sonoma State University's... you guys have turned this thing from what I'm guessing was just a small idea into a huge thing.
It's really grown, yeah. 1.5 million hits on our website in the first 2 weeks of October.
This is when the new one came out.
Yeah. It's just we get a couple million a month anyway. But
Projectcensor.org, the website we're
talking
about.
Exactly. And when Carl founded it, I mean, this is our 29th year of doing this.
Oh, really? So, I had no idea it was that. And welcome back. I'm not sure what you were listening to there. We dropped our ISDN line, and but we're back. We're back, and back with you. So Mercury's retrograde, so, of course, all bets are off. Welcome back to the program. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Essentially, I wanted to send a message out to Joji from Tacoma before I talk about Israel. I'm the education director for America in Solidarity, and we're a workers' advocacy group here in Tacoma, and we'd like to organize something with him around this Oman Free Trade Agreement.
Oh, great. Great.
Yeah, you can check out our website at www.americasolidarity.org.
Okay.
Or call our office at 471-1123.
471-1123. Great. This is something that it's passed the Senate, unfortunately. I'm amazed that there weren't flags flying all over the place about this, or if there were, I missed them. It passed the Senate back at the end of June, about a week and a half ago, or I guess that would be 2 weeks ago. And the following Democrats actually voted for this: Max Baucus, Maria Cantwell, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Mary Landrieu, Joe Lieberman, Ben Nelson, Bill Nelson, Barack Obama, Mark Pryor, Ken Salazar. Those Democrats.
That sounds like a DLC family reunion.
Yep. Yep.
And now it's
in the House of Representatives, and it's gonna take some Republican defections, frankly, in order to stop it.
Well, as
solidarity among the Democrats.
I'm sorry?
As well as solidarity among the Democrats. So, okay, great.
Yeah.
So you've got your website out there, and people can...
I just wanted to say our Maria Cantwell still has a challenger who is opposed to free trade, so if anybody wants to support her, her name's Hong Tran.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll try to get her involved in this as well.
Okay.
This is a serious issue, and Mark Wilson was highlighting it really well, but he sort of disappeared.
Well, Mark Wilson has endorsed Maria Cantwell, and
yeah.
I hope springs eternal. I mean, I'm assuming that you're enough of a political realist to acknowledge that with Mark Wilson dropping out of the race, Maria Cantwell is going to be the Democratic candidate. And
yeah, I've always been kind of a progressive activist and felt that pushing a message from the left is important all the way up until the general. So, you know, I'm not saying I'm going to vote for the Green, but I'll definitely probably vote for Hong Tran in the primary and then, you know, see what happens from there.
Yeah, I think that we need to be trying to enlighten Maria Cantwell rather than trying to wound her. I'm very concerned about a Republican getting that seat. That would be the worst thing that could happen to the United States.
Yeah, our organization has tried to move Maria on this. She's just signed our pledge for working families, so hoping that she'll...
I mean, on at least half the issues, and probably far more than that, Maria Cantwell's a very, very good person, a very good senator. And
that's right.
We can't just single issue any candidate. I just don't think that that's wise.
My organization is almost totally behind her, but I still feel like we got to keep pushing.
Yep, there you go. Now you said you wanted to talk about Israel. Your thoughts on my theory here that this is not everybody's running around saying this is about Iran and Syria. I don't think it's about Iran and Syria.
Not at all.
Hezbollah and Hamas.
Yeah, and the one thing you didn't mention is that both Hezbollah and Hamas were infiltrated 20 or 30 years ago by the IDF, Mossad, and it's possible that these guys weren't even, you know, hardliner, you know, parts of the organization and really just made it a false flag operation to justify the invasion.
Yeah, you know, I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I mean, it's...
I'm just too much of a conspiracy.
I mean, you know, it's politics in the Middle East. Anything is possible. I mean, it's politics anywhere in the world. I mean, politics in Ohio. Anything is possible. But I'm not representing myself here as any kind of Middle Eastern expert, although I have spent a fair amount of time in that region. I have been in several countries in that region. I've been in Israel probably, I don't know, 15, 20 times in my life. And I know, you know, that these issues are very complex. But I really think that the American media is doing us a disservice by repeating the neocon talking point that this is all about Iran. I think that this administration and the right wingers and the neocons are going to try and use this thing to gin up a war against Iran. And it's, as I said, it's really about Hezbollah and Hamas. And, you know, if Iran is the force behind Hezbollah and Hamas, then, you know, we all have a serious problem. We have to acknowledge that and get real about it. If, on the other hand, Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Muslim Brotherhood and these other right-wing extremists, the Jerry Falwells of Islam, if they're the ones who are pushing Iran, then that's a whole other issue. And I just don't think that there's a good analysis of this being done in the American media, frankly.
Media on the issue of Israel, the media is missing.
But by and large, yeah, because it's one of those things where no matter what you say, you're going to get whacked from one side or the other. It is a tough and complex issue. Anyhow, it's Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. By the way, I agree with you about Maria Cantwell. I don't know a lot about her, but I know enough you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that's what you're saying.
On the other hand, if you've got a candidate who has absolutely consistently voted against the interests of the party, like Joe Lieberman, and he's got a strong challenger in the primary, then
that's a different story.
You know, I support Ned Lamont. But if Ned Lamont loses in that primary and Joe Lieberman is the candidate, I would support him because he's a Democrat. Because the first and most important vote that any senator or congressman or woman makes is the vote for leadership.
Right.
Who's going to be running the House and the Senate?
Right. I hope I don't hurt the Democratic Party here in Pennsylvania, but I'm going to make a statement. Put a fork in Rick Santorum. He's done.
Yeah, you mean a turkey baster kind of thing?
I think he's done. I really do. Yeah. I really do.
Yeah.
Well, and
let's hope, you know, politically speaking, let's hope that that's the case.
Yeah, or pray. I'm praying.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And
quick point, Gary.
The final thought, if I may, we have become smug in our own power. Welcome to the Bush legacy.
Yeah, there you go. Gary, thanks for the call. Thanks for the comment. Yep, you too. Have a great weekend. 45 minutes past the hour. I'll be back with your calls and more right after this. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, dreaming of democracy. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Clay Kaplis. Is that it, Clay? Am I pronouncing it right? Kaplis. Thank you very much. I'm sorry about that. Alex Goldmark, Lauren Kirshner at Air America, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you. For listening to our program, thank you so much. I hope you have a great weekend. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jody in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Jody, what's on your mind? Jody, I'm not hearing you.
Hello?
There you go. Okay, hey.
Okay. Hey, when you look at the map of and see Iraq between Iran and Syria, you realize how important it was to have Saddam there. And how there was a veil of mystery. You know, nobody really, you know, knew what he was capable of. No one knew what America was capable of. And to think that, foolishly, you know, Bush took the veil of mystery off and everybody sees the vulnerabilities. And I just think that this would not be happening in Israel. And I don't think this level of intensity and the confidence, overconfidence of the Iran leader, I don't think everyone would have this level of confidence that they did.
In fact, one of the theories about what's going on right now there, and you know, it's being put forward, you know, frankly, by a lot of different people in a lot of different groups, is that one of the reasons that Hezbollah and Hamas have felt sufficiently empowered to essentially take on Israel, which, you know, is generally considered suicidal in that part of the world, is because the United States is tied down in Iraq. In fact, in today's Wall Street Journal, their editorial, which is consistently absolutely pro-Bush, the Wall Street Journal editorial page is like the nerve center for the right-wing extremists in the United States. Today they wrote, and I quote, "Critics of the Bush administration will surely find a way to blame it for the current crisis," this being in Israel and whatnot, "on the theory that this is what happens when you push for change in the Middle East. But the real problem is the growing perception among Arab regimes and terrorist frontmen that the U.S. is so bogged down in Iraq and so suddenly deferential to the wishes of the international community that it's lost its appetite for serious reform. This has created openings for the kind of terror assaults on American allies we are now witnessing." So here you have the Wall Street Journal essentially saying, if Bush hadn't gotten us bogged down with this absolutely screwed up occupation of Iraq, then this wouldn't be happening.
Yeah, and didn't Bush Sr. write a book about that? If you remove Saddam, you are opening a can of worms.
He didn't write a book about it, but he was quoted in somebody's book. I don't remember who or where, but the quotes are all over the place. Yeah, yeah, or maybe it was his book. But, in any case, yes, Bush Sr. said that the reason that he didn't go to Baghdad is because it would have dragged. Actually, even James Baker said that as well, as I recall, who was then Secretary of State, that it would have led to a protracted, bogged down, mess for all practical purposes.
And I don't think the other leaders liked Saddam in that area, right? Wasn't he the only one that really didn't have allies?
Saddam, by and large, because he was secular. Well, Jordan was more or less officially secular, I suppose. But because Saddam was secular, and because Saddam was regarded by many people in the region as nuts, as a
right.
little crazy.
Perfect.
Yeah, he didn't have a lot of allies. I mean, it was one of the reasons that we put him in a place in the first place.
It's perfect. He was perfect for that area.
He was our buffer against Iran.
He was absolutely our buffer for everything. And the fact that we find now, really, that he was just, a guy who would hide in a hole, really, he probably would never have, attacked outwards. He was the perfect person. I mean, obviously, it's 2020, but truly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to acknowledge that he did attack Kuwait. On the other hand, you've got April Gillespie saying to him, well, if you attack Kuwait, which used to be one of the provinces of the Ottoman Empire, and therefore Saddam always figured it was his, 38th state or something like that, April Gillespie, with the U.S. State Department, when he said, what will the U.S. response be if I try to take back Kuwait? And she said, well, we won't have a problem with that, or
and
words to that effect.
You know, another interesting thing, I remember hearing Saddam saying, who is this America? At one point, I don't know how long ago this was, he said, who is this America that wants me, and why are they after me? So, in fact, we could have had, this weird little ally with Saddam, because he didn't even know really who we were.
Well, he actually was our ally, right up until 91, and that's when Bush decided to turn on him, Bush Sr. But he was our ally up to that point. We put him into place. We maintained him. Jody, I got to run. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick, we got about a half a minute. What's up?
Well, I got 3 points of disagreement today. First, I take John Dean at his word that he's a Gold Water conservative, and a Gold Water conservative is not a liberal. I mean, he may be becoming one. I respect his intellect, but not necessarily his integrity.
Well, I would encourage you to read his book.
Well,
we've
got to get beyond the Washington Post version of history, But at any rate, second, to infer that Bush, which I assume is code for the Cheney administration, is a victim of bin Laden, I think that...
No. What I'm saying is that Bush and bin Laden were entirely symbiotic.
Yeah,
that bin Laden wanted somebody to kick back at him loudly, and Bush needed an enemy to play the Reichstag card. I mean, no, absolutely. If that's what you took away from what I said, my apologies. And to the extent that may also be playing out in the Middle East, it's a tragedy. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program on Monday, I'll be debating conservative Lauren Krauss on the values of a tax-free society. And George Lakoff will be here on his new book, Whose Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea. That and more and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, your radio support group for We the People. See you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.